All right, very good. We'll begin then. This is the state of Minnesota versus Stephen Friends. The file number is A200385. Council, you each have 15 minutes for your argument this morning. I want to welcome you here. The appellant will be able to have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I think we can begin. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral argument. And the appellant may proceed at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Robert Richman. I represent the appellant, Stephen Friends. Members of the court, in many ways, this case presents a test to the foundation of our criminal justice system. Mr. Friends lied to the district court and submitted a false affidavit, but the state concedes that he was never given an oath. This is no mere technicality. An oath is an essential element of the crime of perjury. The question here is whether the state will be held to its burden. Mr. Friends could have been charged with other criminal offenses or sanctioned in some other way, but the state chose to pursue a perjury conviction. And having done so, it was obligated to prove every element of the crime, including the administration of an oath, beyond a reasonable doubt. The state having failed in its proof, this court should reverse the conviction.
And I just want to clarify and narrow the issues. There is no dispute as to the fact that all five of the other elements of the six element requirement for a perjury conviction were met here, and that the jury, you're not contesting the other five elements. Am I correct? That's well, not before us. We're only dealing with whether the writing is required or authorized by law to be under oath or affirmation. Isn't that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And my reading of that part of the statute, and as affirmed by this court in Mertz and many other cases cited in my brief, requires not simply that an oath is authorized by law, but that an oath was actually administered, and none was administered here. There are two ways under Minnesota law that a writing can support a perjury prosecution. The first is under 358.07 Minnesota statutes, which sets out the form of oath which shall be administered to an affiant. The word is shall. It is mandatory. The second way is under Minnesota statute 358.116, which states that a writing is treated as a verification upon oath or affirmation without the administration of an oath, if there is an explicit perjury warning. The clear implication of that statute is if there is no perjury warning, as here, then an administration of an oath under 358.07 is required. There is no third way to administer an oath. There is no, as the state suggests, rule that if you have a piece of paper that includes the word sworn, that we'll just treat that as an oath. That does not exist in Minnesota law.
Well, counsel, if I can interrupt you, the affidavit that your client signed affirmed that he was being duly sworn. And at the end, it said, subscribed and sworn to me before. Now, what does the word sworn mean to you?
It means, I think that language can be taken as an attestation. It is certainly evidence that he is under oath. It is not an oath itself. The Supreme Court in the Madigan case dealt with that issue explicitly. And while that case is 100 years old, it is still good law. The court said merely subscribing to the affidavit is not being sworn to it. Now, we concede, as the state argues, and we said in our brief, that an affidavit and the language that you point out is evidence of an oath. It is not an oath, it is evidence of an oath. And the state could have taken the position that Mr. Shields, the notary public, who testified without contradiction that he did not administer an oath, the court could have impeached him with that statement. But Mr. Shields, it says here, subscribed and sworn. Weren't you verifying that there was an oath? That was not the position that the state took in the district court. The state conceded that Mr. Shields' testimony was accurate, that no oath was administered, but instead argued to the jury, and the jury was so instructed, that no oath was required, that the affidavit was good enough. There is nothing in Minnesota law that supports that proposition, and the Madigan case expressly rejects it.
Well, can I ask you, because one thing that the respondent cited was the Day case, and where the Supreme Court said the particular formality with which an oath is administered has never been regarded in this state is of great importance, and that and what the judge referred to is that providing affidavits to the court is a common way of presenting sworn testimony to the court. Why, in light of the Day decision, where they said it's not of great importance how you do it, isn't it enough that the person is signing a document in front of a notary that says they were sworn to this testimony? I mean, why isn't that enough? Why doesn't that meet the threshold of affirmation or an oath?
In the Day case, Your Honor, the court agreed that the oath was sufficient, even though the defendant had not been asked to raise his right hand. And you are correct that the law is, and the perjury statute provides a provision that a mere irregularity in the administration of an oath is not sufficient. But the failure to administer any oath at all cannot be dismissed as simply a mere technicality, a mere irregularity. The Day case made clear that there had to be some formal undertaking that would awaken the person's conscience to the obligation to tell the truth. And this court in the Mertz case made clear that what is necessary for a perjury prosecution to meet that formality is the administration of an oath by an officer authorized to administer it. The court in that case said that the defendant signing his name to a document with a very explicit perjury warning, quote, does not have the same force and effect as a formally sworn oath. It is our position that the state's position requires that this court overrule its decision in Mertz. The Rule 15 of the Minnesota Rules of Practice specify three requirements for a document to be an affidavit. First, it has to be signed. Second, it has to be sworn. Third, it has to be notarized. The state's position that it's good enough if it's signed and notarized simply eliminates the second requirement for an oath. There is a requirement that it be sworn above and beyond the requirement that it be subscribed to. A notary is not sufficient. In the Hall case, an unpublished decision that was cited by the state, there the court dealt with a notarized document that had been a notarized document that had a warning that it was subject to the penalties of law if it was falsely subscribed. The court there said that that was not sufficient for an oath. So there is nothing about a notary that somehow creates an oath without an oath being administered. Anyone who has applied for a bank loan or a mortgage has signed reams of papers before a notary. And most of those documents are simply attesting to the fact that the person appearing before you is the person whose name is on the document. It is a verification of identity that is completely different from the administration of an oath. And
it also is completely different from the affidavit before us in this case. Your client attested to the facts, having been duly sworn.
It contains that language. And as I said, it is evidence that there was an oath, but the Madigan court makes clear it is not an oath. That language creates a presumption that an oath has been administered. And in the absence of any other evidence, that presumption alone would be sufficient. But the Madigan court and every court since then has made clear that that presumption is not irrebuttable. It is subject to rebuttal. Here, it was rebutted by the notary public, whose testimony stands uncontradicted, that he did not administer an oath.
Well, it was uncontradicted, but that doesn't mean the jury had to believe it. The notary in question was what, an employee of Mr. Friends?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so it was very self-serving on the part of Mr. Friends to have his employee say something that would negate this affidavit.
And had the state taken the position that Mr. Shields was lying, then there would have been an issue for the jury. But in the district court and again in this court, the state conceded that there was no oath administered, and the jury was told that that was irrelevant. And those were the jury instructions as well, that the affidavit itself was sufficient. So the jury was never given an option of weighing the language of the affidavit against the testimony of Mr. Shields. The state conceded that there was no oath given.
But are you reading Madigan too far, though? Because I'm just looking at the respondent's brief here. And they talk, you know, the respondent points out that there was even a question as to whether that was in effect the defendant's signature and identity. And then they quote this, the respondent quotes this, but it's well stated that when the signatures are proved as above stated, it is presumed that it was actually sworn to by the person whose signature is subscribed as affiant. I mean,
correct. It is presumed. And the decision then goes on to say, which my colleague did not bother to quote, that presumption is not irrebuttable. And I discuss Madigan at length in my brief. The law in this state is that when there is a presumption, which in this case, there is a presumption from the form of the affidavit, that the affidavit was sworn, and that allows affidavits to be relied on by courts and businesses without the need of a notary testifying. But if the presumption is rebutted, as it was here by the testimony of Mr. Shields, the presumption disappears and the burden.
But didn't the jury consider evidence though that it was rebutted? Because wasn't there evidence that your client had signed hundreds of these and was well aware that the courts use these statements as sworn testimony? I mean, didn't the jury have those facts before it and basically coming up with a verdict of guilty?
No, Your Honor, there were facts to that effect, but the state conceded that there was no oath and the court instructed the jury that the affidavit was sufficient to constitute an oath, not in those exact words, but that was the essence of it. The presumption that the form of the affidavit creates that there is that the affidavit was sworn was rebutted. The presumption is then disappears, and the burden is on the state to prove that there was an oath administered, which the Mertz court has said, this court has said, requires an oral administration of an oath. That didn't happen in this case. This is a criminal statute that is being interpreted here. It is must be strictly construed in favor of the defendant. This is not a technicality. There is no authority under the law for simply treating as an oath the statement sworn. That is does not exist in the law. That the legislature could have created a crime that falsely attesting to facts in a document that purports to be an affidavit is the crime of perjury. But the state has not done so. It created in 358.07 the form of oath that is required for an affiant, which must be substantially complied with. Because the state has failed in its burden, we ask the court to reverse the conviction. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
This respondent may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Appellant is not challenging the fact that he lied in an affidavit or that he submitted this affidavit to a judge intending the court to rely on the assertions as if they were the undisputed truth. Had the court relied on these lies, the tenant lawsuit would legally have been required to be dismissed. Instead, appellant is claiming that he should be absolved of these lies because he says he never raised his hand and swore to tell the truth before signing the affidavit and having it notarized. This court should reject appellant's invitation to excuse his conduct, affirm the district court's instructions, and the jury's verdict. The state has offered two different ways in which this court can affirm. First, the plain language of the statute, which the elements of the offense do not require that an oath be administered. The element of the offense is the writing is required or authorized by law to be under oath or affirmation. The statute is not, as appellant asserts, that the statement must be materially false, made in a writing that is in fact under oath. The statute reads, it's a writing that is required by law to be under oath. A notarized summary judgment affidavit meets the plain language of that statute. And looking at that, you analyze what the writing is at issue. And the writing at issue here shows that it is required by law to be under oath. And that's where the Hall case, which I cited, it's unpublished. The court looks to each claim of the source of law to interpret whether it is required to have an oath attached to it. Now, the rule of law that the appellant is asking this court to adopt would authorize litigants to lie and notarize affidavits submitted in support of summary judgment. And if you get away with it, then summary judgment is granted in your favor. If you get caught in those shenanigans, you lie with impunity. If you have your notary say, I didn't have the person raise their hand and administer an oath at the time that they signed it. At that point, the rules of summary judgment would need to be amended so you have an affidavit of the notary to say, I actually made the person raise their hand and swear to this information. A court should be able to trust that when a notarized affidavit is in fact submitted to the court, it is presenting admissible facts. That is what is required by the rule, and that is how the summary judgment works. Now, if the court were to conclude that an oath must be administered and is required, the state has always argued and asserts again before the court that the writing itself can provide the oath. If the signatures are proved, the court can presume that it was sworn to the person who signed it. The oath itself is an affirmation defined as an affirmation of truth of a statement, which requires, there's no particular formality, the Minnesota Supreme Court has said, in which the oath must be administered. And so if the writing itself is sworn to and goes through the formality and the process of presenting it to a notary, having a notary stamp it, sworn and subscribed to me, and sign off on that, that in itself is enough for an oath, the oath requirement. The writing shows that the oath was administered, or at a minimum, not administered, but at a minimum was signed under oath.
All right. Now, the counsel refers to basically two cases, the Mertz case and the Madigan case, and argues that in State v. Mertz, that the court there basically said that even though the document said if you write this, if you don't fill out this request for a public defender accurately, you could be charged with a crime. I mean, which is pretty strong language, and it was signed in front of a sheriff, but there was no oath administered, and there was no notary, and that this just shows how important it is that there be an oath, because that case was dismissed, the perjury charges were dismissed. What's your response to the Mertz case?
As far as Mertz go, there's no need for this court to overrule Mertz. That has not been the state's position in this case. Mertz stands for what it is, which charged a different subsection of the statute. Mertz was not looking at whether the writing at issue is required by law to be under oath. Mertz charged was charged under subsection 1-1, whereas the appellant was charged under subsection 1-2. That's one distinguishing feature. So the court was not looking at whether the writing that the applicant signed was required by law to be under oath. There's no question here that the affidavit signed, sworn, attesting to facts is required by law to be under oath when submitted in support of summary judgment. The other thing is Mertz signed that document in front of a sheriff's deputy. Friends, however, notarized the document, had it stamped and signed by a notary, and submitted it for purposes of summary judgment. And it's important to remember that the perjury occurred here at that time of the signing of the affidavit and then submitting it for purposes of summary judgment. That is the timing of when the perjury actually occurred, and trying to lie to the court to get a case dismissed. So the court doesn't need to dismiss Mertz, and I'm happy to address Madigan unless you have a question following up on that.
No, you can go ahead to Madigan.
So Madigan, it did not appear that the defendant actually swore to the affidavit. The court said the affidavit itself was sufficiently authenticated. And it's important because the defendant signed, had a notary seal, had a notary sign that affidavit. There was no testimony, at least that I could find in the court's opinion, that would support the position that an oath was actually administered. Now, the often cited language from appellant's counsel is the merely subscribing to the affidavit is not being sworn to it. But the very next line in that opinion is when signatures are proved, it's presumed to be sworn to by the parties. In Madigan, it seems that Friends is making the same argument here that was made in Madigan, which is essentially the affidavit was too false to constitute perjury. And going down that line, it's important to look at the words that are in the affidavit. It is sworn to. It was sworn to me. It was subscribed. He attested to facts. It was submitted in purposes for summary judgment pursuant to a rule that requires admissible evidence be put before the court. And the argument here is that this was so false that he wasn't even trying to put admissible evidence before the court, even though it was submitted in support of a motion for summary judgment. So that's my response, at least to the Mertz and the Madigan cases.
All right.
Mr. Schmidt, go ahead.
You should go, Judge Slater.
Mr. Schmidt, getting to then following up on Madigan with regard to the issue of jury instructions, are you satisfied? And if so, how was the jury properly instructed consistent with Madigan? such that the presumption might be rebutted.
I am comfortable with the instructions as given. They were not an abuse of discretion. The language when administered does not make it optional. And that was sort of the key language there about there's no objection to that, the when administered. So that would be a plain error. And it's not making the oath optional. The jury instructions were an accurate statement of the law. And they were properly instructed that an irregular manner of an oath is not a defense, which is essentially the entire argument that is being made here. We assert that if an oath is required, the writing itself can provide for that oath. And the attack here is a prohibited defense, that this oath was administered in an irregular manner. Now, if the court is looking at that the oath is required as part of this, the other facts that were submitted to the jury support the verdict. The other facts show that Mr. Friends was a business person, undergrad in finance, master's in business, and a frequent litigant. He signed many affidavits, upwards of 750 in 15 years. And not only that, he was represented by very good counsel at Frederickson and Byron. Now, the argument may have some traction and with a jury had he been a pro se litigant and had no idea what signing an affidavit means, that you are submitting facts that are undisputed to a court as if they were admissible evidence. That was not what the jury heard. And the jury didn't have to believe Mr. Friends' witnesses. They were instructed on credibility. They could reject that and say, you know what? I don't believe the notary. That I think that is false. I think he's too close to him. And I think given the frequency in which he signed affidavits and was in court and litigation, that he knew exactly what he was doing and he was submitting this under oath.
Mr. Schmidt, is this a matter of first impression for the court?
I believe it is. And I think it's probably worth publishing the decision either way, whether you rule for me or you rule for the appellant. I do think this is a matter of first impression.
Well, can I ask you this? Because, there's two ways that you could look at this. One is that the rule of law would be if we adopt your position that an affidavit, which is sworn to and attested to, that is sufficient that is sufficient to qualify as an oath or affirmation without going any further. All right, that would be one way we could look at this case. But then the alternative would be that an affidavit, which is sworn to and attested to, it's presumed that that's the case, that it's sworn to and attested to. And then it's a presumption that's presented to the jury, which can be the affiant can rebut that. How should we, what are the pros and cons, I guess, in adopting one position as opposed to the other? Where it's just a presumption versus as a matter of law, it constitutes an oath or affirmation.
Well, and Judge, if I may, I would add to those statements about the affidavit sworn to, attested to add notarized, stamp and signature sworn and subscribed to that notary. So right. I think that's an important addition to that, because if you're signing it without the notary, then you are like the McDonald Broadcorp case that appellant cites, where McDonald's affidavit wasn't an affidavit because it wasn't notarized.
Right. So when I use affidavit, I'm assuming it's been signed and notarized by a notary.
And so I would assert and ask this court to adopt the plain language of the statute, which is the writing which is required or authorized by law to be under oath or affirmation. There isn't anything in there that talks about a presumption. There isn't anything that talks about you can rebut this. if it is a writing that is required by law to be under oath and it's submitted to a court for purposes of presenting admissible evidence, that is the end of the analysis. When it is signed, notarized, attested to, sworn to, all the other keys of an affidavit. Now, if it is a rebuttable presumption, again, the state would assert that the writing itself can provide the oath, and the facts that were put before the jury showed that Mr. Friends was a frequent litigant who signed many, many affidavits and knew exactly that this was an under oath document that he was submitting to put admissible evidence before a court. So with that, we would ask that the court affirm because the elements were met and the perjury conviction should stand. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Rickman, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The parade of horribles cited by my colleague are not going to come to pass if the court rules in favor of Mr. Friends. We will not do away with affidavits. We will not require testimony of notary publics. The issue in this case is a narrow one. Is an oath required to sustain a perjury prosecution? The state's suggestion that litigants will simply be free to lie to courts is simply not true. There are remedies under Rule 60B, there are sanctions provided for under Rule 11, and the state could have charged Mr. Friends with fraud had it chosen to. It didn't. It charged him with perjury, which has very particular requirements. The state's position that no oath is required under the perjury statute is belied by Mertz, by Day, by Madigan, and by many other cases cited in my brief. That position would require the court to undo the law of perjury going back to the common law. The Mertz case is indistinguishable from this case, although it's true that that case was under 1.1, and this case is under 1.2. Both contain identical language about authorized or required by law. It has always been the case that an oath is required. This court asked, and I think framed the question perfectly, whether the court should consider an affidavit to be sufficient, regardless of whether it's sworn, or whether it should treat it as simply being a presumption subject to rebuttal. The answer to that question is the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Madigan case has already said the answer is number two. It can only be treated as a presumption subject to rebuttal. And if the court said instead that an affidavit as a matter of law is sufficient, it would do away with the three requirements of an affidavit, not two, the three requirements that it be signed, sworn, and notarized. The court cannot simply do away with the sworn part of the analysis and say that the affidavit alone is sufficient. The state makes much of the fact that Mr. Friends had a lot of experience with signing documents before notary publics. The evidence was not clear whether those were affidavits or simply attesting to his signature. But the issue here is not whether Mr. Friends believed he was under oath. The issue is whether he was under oath. And the elements of this crime pertain to an experienced person with a business degree just as much as they apply to a pro se litigant. Either way, the burden is on the state to prove each and every element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt, which includes the requirement of the administration of an oath.
You know, can I go back to the Day case, though? If the court has said we're not going to be too formalistic about this oath, I mean, does it really matter whether the oath is orally given or whether you sign a writing that says you're swearing to this evidence, well, and you're affirming this evidence?
it may be a different case if this affidavit contained language along the lines, I am attesting to the truth of this affidavit, I am declaring under pains of perjury. This affidavit did not mention the word oath, it did not mention the word perjury, it did not mention the word truth. It had the word sworn.
Yes. And attest.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that signing a document that contains those two words is not the sort of solemn undertaking which the Day Court contemplated and the law contemplates to awaken a litigant's awareness, awakens his conscience of the duty to tell the truth. This court made clear in the Mertz case that that obligation requires the formal administration of an oath.
Well, could you tell me, what's the difference, though, if I, as a judge, swear somebody in, and I say, you do swear that ye shall give the evidence, so, you know, so help you God, that you will be truthful, and having someone sign a document that says, I swear to this evidence. I mean, what difference does it make? I mean, if
Mr. Friends is not a lawyer. The document does not say, I swear to tell the truth. It does not say I will be subject to a perjury prosecution. There is no evidence that he was ever warned of that fact, even in the Mertz case, even when he was warned of that fact, very clearly that he was subject to a perjury prosecution. That was not enough. This court has said the oral administration of an oath is the touchstone, which complies with 358.07. It complies with the statutory framework that was created by the legislature. This court should not be creating a new form of oath that has not been created by the legislature. Therefore, we urge the court to reverse the conviction.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, thank you very much. And thank you, counsel, for your very helpful oral arguments today and your very well done brief. So we will be issuing a decision within the statutory period of time. Thank you.
Thank you.